When I arrived in Bali at the end of my gap year, it marked a significant transition for me. Instead of taking a gap year during my schooling years, I decided to take this year off after completely burning myself out in my last job. I knew I needed a break, and I'd saved up enough to explore the world, a dream of mine for a long time. However, as the year went by, I began feeling lost. Although I had fun along the way, I didn't feel any closer to knowing what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. With the milestone of turning 30 approaching in a few short years, it felt like I wasted the year doing nothing instead of making something of myself. Then I saw a Facebook post from a new life coach who was looking for people to practice on. I decided to take her up on an offer of a free session because at that point I felt like I had nothing to lose. Opening up to a complete stranger in a tropical cafe was uncomfortable, but she helped me reframe my gap year. In that year without work, I had traveled, made new friends, and gotten out of my comfort zone by traveling alone, learning how to be more independent. I also became more available to the people I cared about the most. Having unlimited time allowed me to prioritize being a good friend and helping a friend through a terrible breakup, even if I was on the other side of the world. Although I wasn't any closer to knowing what my vocation would be, I began to see the identity I started building for myself in my personal life. Welcome to Self-Help Junkie, the podcast where we explore the world of personal development through the eyes of book enthusiasts. I'm your host, Erica Ng, a communication coach and your resident bookworm. This season, we'll be focused on finding purpose, motivation, and inspiration. But before we dive into the conversation with our guest, let's get a one-minute summary of the book. Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor E. Frankl explores the human quest for meaning and purpose, particularly in the face of suffering and adversity. Frankl was initially a successful neurologist and psychiatrist in Vienna before being deported to Auschwitz and later to other concentration camps. Despite facing unimaginable cruelty, starvation, and loss, Frankl observed that some prisoners maintained their humanity and dignity while others succumbed to despair and degradation. Throughout his internment, Frankl found purpose and meaning in helping fellow prisoners, providing psychological support, and even conducting therapeutic sessions, which he documents in his book. He discovers that those who had a sense of purpose or a reason to live were more likely to survive the brutality of the camps. Two key ideas that the book deals with are freedom of choice, the importance of inner freedom, which cannot be taken away even in the harshest of conditions, and logotherapy, which, unlike other forms of therapy that dwell on the past traumas, emphasizes the present and future, guiding individuals towards a purposeful existence. And with that, let's dive in. Today, we have on Gary Fay, the founder of Strong Mend, and is a life strategist, mental strength, and performance specialist. Prior to this, he was part of the Australian Federal Police Force, where he led the Australian Prime Minister's personal protection team. So we actually have a real-life superhero on today. Welcome to the show, Gary.
Well, thank you very much for having me on, Erica. And I've not really been called that before. I've been called plenty of other things, but not that, and I'll take it.
I wanted to ask, Liz, how often do you meet someone who is on protection detail? What is the job like compared to what we see portrayed in movies? Are there any similarities?
nothing would be the answer. No, that's not entirely true. Look, the movies certainly add a Hollywood flair to the role. We certainly do it differently in Australia than what people will have seen from the US Secret Service looking after their president. But there is some similarities in the way people move around and talk. It's certainly dramatized for Hollywood. But, you know, some days are very exciting. Unfortunately, what Hollywood doesn't show is the many days sitting around in offices or, hotel rooms and not doing a great deal. But there's some enjoyable moments of it as well.
Very interesting. So you transitioned from doing that to something very different now. And we're going to, I'm guessing, be talking a lot about that transition over. You've kind of developed a passion for psychology. Did you find yourself, while you were still working on the police force, already starting to build some of that passion, that some of that curiosity?
Well, I think that the answer is yes. However, it was very naive curiosity. I was always interested in performance fields. I probably wasn't accomplished, but did hang around and associate with elite sports earlier on in my life, and obviously my federal police career followed a performance or high performance path with the Prime Minister's team, and then subsequently running the Commissioner's office. Mm-hmm. And I'd always had a keen interest in mindset and mental strength, as mm-hmm. I knew it back then. Unfortunately, I think, like many people, I was living a performance-based identity mm-hmm. and thought that mental strength and mental toughness were really just about being hard and hardening up and not having problems and you know mm-hmm. sweeping them all under the table. And unfortunately for me, I suppose, depending on perspective, it was fortunate also that, you know, I went through a major battle with mental health, a major depressive disorder and a gambling addiction over a 10-year period. And that gambling addiction cost me $2 million. It cost me my career, cost me my reputation, and had me very seriously considering the value of my own life. And ultimately, I suppose in one way or another, I was forced into a position of really having to understand and learn how the brain and the mind and the mm-hmm. psychology works, not from that former naive point of view, but from a reality point of view of how does this work? How does a smart, educated, high-performing individual suffer from, these issues for such right. a long period of time without ever doing anything about it? And, that's what led me down the track of studying neuroscience, psychology, peak performance, and really putting the pieces together, first of all, to get my own life back in order. And then I was able to draw on some of the things from my past life, a lot of the things I've learned in my own journey, and then some of the things I've studied. And I really found that area resonates a lot with me, the psychology of peak performance, working with people that are in performance fields, either individuals, teams, or companies. And, you know, some of them are having some struggles. For some, it's a rock bottom, and for others, they're just on the edge of that greatness and want to move forward. And, I've really enjoyed that experience, although, you know, there was a time in the middle of it that I wouldn't have classed it as enjoyable, that's for sure.
Right. And that kind of transitions us into the book beautifully. So you brought in today Man's Search for Meaning. It's one that I think most people have heard of, but may not necessarily have picked up on their own. So how did you first encounter this book? What was your life looking like at that point?
Yeah, I mean, by the time I got to Man's Search for Meaning, I'd actually moved, I suppose, quite a bit past my struggles. So I was mm-hmm. probably, 3 or 4 years into even the career that I'm in now. And, I very much found things like stoicism through that process mm-hmm. and again, neuroscience and psychology. And I'd heard about Man's Search for Meaning, and I left it alone a little bit. It's not a book that typically pops up in the personal development world or the mindset space, but it for me, it very much was. And I wish I had have come across it and paid attention to it, some 10 or 15 years earlier. But, it's quite a dark topic. For those that don't know, it is about Viktor Frankl's experience in concentration camps in World War II. But it very much for me highlighted the value of perspective, mm-hmm. meaning, and purpose. And by the time I came across it, I'd been working very hard on outlining and I suppose understanding my purpose and where I fit in my own world, mm-hmm. and then where I could fit in others. And again, I often draw on the book purely from a perspective point of view. I mean, you're talking about one of the greatest atrocities the world has ever seen, and mm-hmm. to hear somebody speak so eloquently about meaning and purpose in those moments brought to light the fact that we do have a choice, mm-hmm. as tough as it might be on some occasions. But, that was inspiring for me to keep going on the journey, and then, working with others that may have struggled to find that meaning and purpose in their life.
Right. I agree with you. I've been running this podcast for a while, but this is really the first narrative book that someone has brought in. And as difficult as the things that he talks about in this book, you've really connected to the humanity of it. And it's one thing for someone in a self-help book to be like, do A, B, and C. Solved. It's another to see someone who's lived it and struggled with it and seen the challenges that come with that. Yeah. For you, was there anything that particularly stood out in this book that really connected with you or that you wish you had connected with 15 years earlier?
Yeah, look, I think it's, you know, it's very important for me to point out that by no means did my struggles come anywhere near as close to the struggles that Viktor Frankl went through or any of the people that were there. But something that I'd learned before I came across that book was the ability to, you know, the way I looked at perspective, I suppose if I can tell another story, was for a long time when I was struggling, I was masking it for myself. But even when I started to perhaps dip my toe in the water of looking around for options to get better, I always found myself coming up with excuses of, well, this won't work for me because that person's got a different story to me. And that won't work for me because that's not my scenario. That won't work for me because, you know, that's based on, you know, somebody who lives in a different country and not in Australia and they were never in the federal police. And, you know, I just kept finding reasons why all of these strategies wouldn't work for me because for some reason I thought I must have been different. And I came across a 7-minute video on YouTube. I talk about it often. Tony Robbins Saves a Marriage is what it's called, and kind of had nothing to do with my circumstance. You know, I had some relationship issues, but, you know, had nothing to do with gambling and nothing really to do with depression. But it was the first time I listened to somebody talk and thought, I can hear me in this story. And that really shifted my perspective in the fact that I then started to take into every conversation with people, how can I use their story and learn something about myself? How can I learn from those people? How can I take somebody else's struggle to success story and translate it into my world? And when I read Man's Search for Meaning, again, vastly, vastly different experiences in terms of the struggle, but I could resonate with it. The fact that, you know, there was this period of time where I was in struggle and, you know, he talks about those that didn't find meaning or couldn't find purpose and that how much harder they had it. And in fact, I think he talks about the fact that they were more likely to not come out at the other side if they weren't able to find that meaning for where they were. And that really resonated with me, that once I started to find that meaning and that purpose, that even though my struggles still existed, they felt different. They felt like I had some control and some power over them. And they felt like that there would be somewhere for me to go, that I was moving forward and not stuck holding on to the negativity of this situation. And, you know, just throughout that book, it was that focus on purpose, on meaning, on finding meaning in the worst of circumstances. And, you know, even in my own life, my gambling experiences haven't been the worst that I've been through. But I've used that book to be able to, you know, shift perspective and allow myself to be sad and down and negative and angry when it's required, but also to look for the joy, to look for the positivity, to look for the opportunity, to look for, you know, what can I do in this circumstance that I control? And I found it very, very powerful in order for me to not just grow, but to keep growing.
And you said that you had already started working on finding your purpose prior to coming across this book. Can you talk a little bit more about what that looked like for you? Maybe even just starting from the beginning, like what was the situation like with your gambling addiction? What did your life look like then?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'd always gambled. I'm, you know, obviously my accent, I'm in Australia. It's a gambling culture. I think per capita, we gamble far more than anybody else.
I recently learned this. Yeah.
And I'm now, I suppose oddly enough, I'm now doing a PhD in psychology and gambling is the major part of my topic. But, but you know, I gambled most of my life. I remember distinctly putting bets on when I was 8 years old. Telephone bets. So, you know, if maybe I had a deep voice at eight and, and that's how it worked. But You know, so it had been a part of my life for a long period of time, and you know, it was seemingly normal. Everybody was doing it, and then it gradually got worse and worse for me, I suppose. As I earned more money, I could gamble more money, and then I started to find myself gambling a lot on my own and gambling at home, and you know, gambling on my phone, and it was taking me away from things that I wanted to do. Right. And you know, there was periods of time where I did seek help for it, but ultimately, I think gambling became an escape for me. There was there was a lot of noise in my head, I suppose, and things that I not necessarily wasn't comfortable with, but things that I hadn't explored in my own mind. I'm not talking about, you know, deep traumas and things that happen to you when you're a kid, but you know, just vulnerability of who I was as a person and where I was going. And you know, on reflection, it feels to me as though what I was probably doing was what a lot of people do. I was pandering to, you know, the external expectations, you know, the expectations of parents, the expectations of family, of friends, of career paths, that I'd started on this path of performance and now had to keep going. And so any struggle to me felt like a chink in the armor, and it had to be pushed down because that wasn't going to get me where I was going. And so I used gambling as an escape. And unfortunately, as that noise got louder and louder, the gambling became more and more. And again, over that 10-year period, we're, you know, looking at a $2 million gambling loss, but, you know, again, also the loss of my career, and making some very stupid decisions with work credit cards, and really taking me off a path of who I was as a person. And, you know, so that was, you know, it was difficult to go through. And you know, it was something that had I been more aware of myself, more in control of my own mental strength, then I dare say I would have had the self-awareness to recognize far earlier than I did that the problem was there.
I imagine also looking so successful on the outside, it must have felt wrong to feel like something was wrong, because you had a great job, you are successful, you're like dependent, like people depend on you. And then to say like, I don't have things under control would have been such a juxtaposition.
Yeah. Well, it's very difficult when your life is built around being a problem solver.
Yeah.
To have a problem. And, you know, again, at the time, subconsciously, it feels like if I've got a problem, then that steals away my identity. Right. My identity was as a problem solver, as the person that you go to if you're struggling, as the person that you can look up to. Right. And the mistake I made, and again, for a long period of time, this is a subconscious mistake, was that if I struggle with something, I can no longer be that person that my identity said that I was. And, you know, so I kept pushing that down and pushing it down. And at some stage, it bubbles over in the wrong ways. And, you know, again, for me, that was gambling. For a lot of other people, it's different things. You know, anything from drinking, alcohol, drugs, cheating on their partners, buying flash toys and cars, and, you know, sitting on the lounge and, you know, doing nothing, watching Netflix, you know, that it manifests in a multitude of different ways. And yeah, for me, it took me down a dark path of gambling. And, you know, once, you know, my career had come to an end, I started working a bit more into gambling, and, you know, it subsided for a bit, but it came back because that, again, that wasn't my problem. I mean, it was a problem. There's no doubt about that it was a problem, but it wasn't the problem. And it wasn't until part of my struggle got leaked to the media about a year after I'd left the police, and they put in the media where I'd moved to, and, you know, where I lived, and some of the details. And, you know, that really caused me a lot of struggle, because, you know, I'd moved with a family at the time, and I'd fallen back into gambling, and I started to think that, you know, now I'm actually doing more harm to people around me than, you know, I was smart enough to know that suicide is not the answer, but I was also starting to get to the point where, you know, I've tried to solve this problem multiple times over 10 years and have failed. And the only thing that I'm doing now is hurting those people around me more and more. And a way for that to stop is for me to not be here. Thankfully, I made a good choice in that moment and went and spoke to a doctor. And it was probably the first tough promise that I kept to myself, mm-hmm. Was to do whatever the doctor suggested, and then whatever the psychiatrist suggested, and then whatever the psychologist suggested. And, you know, even when it wasn't working completely at the start, I just kept saying to myself, just do what they ask you to do. Don't question. Just keep turning up. Keep keeping your promises to yourself. And eventually, over a 9-month period, I was able to shift my identity from somebody who was really struggling in life and with gambling to not just somebody who was, had moved past his gambling, but somebody that had a real opportunity to engage the skills that he'd learned over that 10-year period.
Mm. And you're saying like the turning point was when you made and kept this promise to yourself. I'm guessing because this was a long struggle for you, you'd made promises to yourself before. What was different about it this time? Or was it similar to other times and it just stuck this time?
Yeah, the one thing I've learned, you know, certainly over the last, 8 or 9 years is that probably the biggest struggle that people have when they want to change their lives is the ability to keep promises to themselves. Mm. You know, self-confidence, I'm not the first person to say this, but self-confidence is nothing more than the ability to keep promises to yourself. And most people who want to make a significant change in their life and can't, they usually can't because they lack self-confidence and they lack confidence in their ability to keep the big promise. And, I don't know that there was anything different this time. It was the first time I'd really got, I suppose, close to, to that suicidal ideation. Mm-hmm. That can scare a man into doing things that he might not have done before.
Sure.
I don't know if it was just a bit of determination, a bit of potentially trying to prove other people wrong, or I'd just been tired of fighting. The battle for that long that it was like, well, I'll just give it to somebody else. Whatever they tell me to do, I'll do. And then I'll sort the next step out after that. But, you know, going back now, I've actually found that one of the best things that I did for myself was along that path, I started a small journal of keeping promises to myself. Mm. I didn't know that that's what I was necessarily doing at the time. But it was simple things like I didn't hit snooze on my alarm. That is something I coach people now. This is the first thing for people to do. If you hit snooze on your alarm, don't make any other promises to yourself apart from don't hit snooze for a week. That's it. And for me, it was get up 15 minutes earlier. And after a little while when that habit stuck, I started to drink 500 mils of water after I woke up. And when that stuck, I started to have a cold shower. And when that stuck, I started to do some stretches. I started to write a gratitude practice. And gradually what I was doing was learning to keep promises to myself.
Right.
And at the time, I was still gambling. I was seeking help for gambling. And it was a 9-month period. And I would go to gambling help and I'd go to psychologist and sometimes I'd leave there and go gamble straight away. And part of me would think, well, you're a failure. You're going to this thing. You know, you shouldn't be going. And another part of me just said, just keep going. Just keep doing that. That's not your focus right now. Keep these promises to yourself, the little ones, the ones that you can keep, right? Because in that moment, I couldn't keep the big promise to myself. I didn't have that skill set. And eventually over 9 months of doing these small things and changing my habits and learning more about myself, I just got tired of gambling. I became a different person. I created a new identity. I created the identity of someone who could keep promises to himself. Mm-hmm. I didn't focus necessarily on the gambling as the one thing. And you know, people who have tried to lose weight will have found the same experience that if you focus so hard on this big, massive promise that you've made to yourself, it's just very hard to keep it. But if you chip away at it with little promises and little pieces of action, then one day you wake up and you're already past where you thought you could get to. And, you know, that was part of that first, you know, process for me to get to the what might have been the start line of the rest of my life.
Mm. Right. As you were talking about the building trust in yourself, that really sounded like how you would build trust in a relationship as well. It's not the big grand gestures that someone does. It's the daily small things that are going to show up every day and showing up in that way. And I love the idea that it shouldn't be tackling the biggest thing yet. If you haven't built up the muscles of keeping promises to yourself, don't make a promise that you're going to break and feel like you're defeated after that.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, you know, we're still in January now, and, you know, but many people would have made and already broken their New Year's resolutions. And it's why New Year's resolutions rarely stick. It's because people get to December 31, they make themselves a huge promise that they're going to do something for the whole year. But their brain knows, you know, look, they'll write it out for a couple of weeks, and their mind knows that, hey, you're going to quit at some stage. So, yeah, we'll just pretend like we're going to do this for a little while, and then all of a sudden you'll forget your shoes, or it'll be raining, or something will go wrong, and, you know, you're back at square one again. And, you know, I'll tell people, if you want to make a New Year's resolution, you got to start on the 1st of December, build some skills that you can actually keep promises to yourself. Right. And then make a promise that you might try and keep. You know, it's very difficult to make a huge promise straight out of the bat, in particular because your history has probably demonstrated that you won't keep it.
Mm-hmm. For sure. And so you've been building this identity for yourself. Now you're a person that can trust yourself. Your gambling has been minimized. What was next? What became your purpose? What made you want to wake up every day?
Yeah, well, I mean, I've done a lot of work on figuring out who I am and my identity and articulating it. And you know, at the start, I just lived it and started, you know, doing certain things. And then it needed to have some deeper meaning and deeper purpose to me. And so I did a lot of work around who I was as a person, not based on what I did, not based on, you know, my circumstances in life, but what, you know, character do I have? Not always did I demonstrate it, that's for sure. But deep down, if my emotions couldn't get in the way, who was I genuinely? And, you know, at the top of that list for me, top of that values list is purpose. And you know, for a long period of time, that purpose solely for me was to make sure that my pain meant something. And that's all my purpose was. And it was to, in a number of different facets. And that was, you know, I'd had an experience, and I needed to make sure that pain that I went through wasn't for nothing, that not only could I learn from it, that I could potentially help others with that, with the experience that I had, but to also make sure that I put my family and my friends in better positions than I had before. To make sure that I put my own health and mental health and financial well-being in a better place than I had before. The purpose wasn't just superficial, take the pain of gambling and depression and make sure that you learn from that, but learn from the entire experience and to become a man that I could be proud of. And the great thing about that is that's a journey that should continue for the rest of my life. That there is no end game to becoming somebody that you can be proud of, because, you know, for every step forward you take, there's a new version that you could be proud of. And, you know, and so that's still my overarching, you know, value to this day. And, you know, there are some other things that I always make sure I look after. You know, part of living out that purpose is gratitude, is growth, is discipline. Is service and is presence as well, to make sure that I'm 100% present with who I'm with or wherever I am, and that all of that person goes with me. And, you know, I found that the greatest performers in the world, those that stay at the top of their game for the longest, they do so because they build a purpose-based identity, not a performance-based identity, not built through talent, but really built through meaning and understanding. And, you know, that's where I've been fortunate enough to get to today. I found that, you know, talking to people about my own struggles initially got me started down that path. And You know, I've lived a life of high performance. I'd like to think I live it again, and I've learned a lot about it, formally, informally, and I've earned my way here through, you know, actually boots on the ground, doing the work that it takes, and it's been a good journey. Again, there were times when I was in the middle of it that I wouldn't have said that, but I'm very grateful for the experiences that I've had.
Yeah. And you've mentioned emotions a couple of times throughout the time that we've been talking. Like if emotions didn't get in the way, who would you be? I feel like emotions is one of those things that men deal with a little differently and maybe haven't been taught ways to constructively deal with. Do you have any advice around that? What do you advise the people that you work with?
Yeah, certainly the men and women typically would experience emotional reactions differently. Not always, but in a typical sense. but ultimately, for everybody, if there's an experience that you have that brings you an element of regret or that you wish you had done differently, neurologically speaking, your emotions have gotten in the way. Now, it may not be that you're angry or that you're crying, but it may be that your emotions have gotten in the way and you have done something to please somebody else or to please social media. And there's a part of you that goes, yeah, I don't know that I really should have done that. That's an indicator that your emotional brain is getting in the way. The primal brain, the you know, the one that's built on survival. And, you know, there's another part of our brain. I would call it the primed part of our brain, the human part, the logical part. And that often doesn't get a say. It's a lot slower to react. We don't train it. And because we don't train it, it usually loses out to the emotional side of our brain. And often for the people that I work with, again, you know, a lot of them are men, but not always, you know, probably about 70% are men, but you know, in performance fields, in action takers, a lot of them like to understand what's going on. And so I will describe to them this, you know, this three-pronged attack of our brain, I suppose, where you've got the primed brain, that human element, you've got the primal brain, that, you know, that almost that monkey, you know, element to it. And then you've got the programmed brain, that computer that just learns from the other two systems. And typically what we do over time is the emotional brain will work five times faster than the human brain. And so the emotional brain says something, we do it, that tells the program that this is the way we behave in all of these circumstances. If we do it long enough, if we keep repeating that behavior, then the program just says, oh, when I get stuck in traffic, I yell and scream. When I see cake, I eat it, right? And it doesn't even bother to ask the human brain, hey, what do you think we should do today? And so what I try and help people with is, you know, I call that emotional side of your brain the big dog. That's the big dog in the fight. It's faster, it's louder. It usually gets what it wants. And so I tell people, you've got to build while the big dog sleeps. So you've got to work on your human, logical, primed part of your brain when you are not emotional. You can't argue with a three-year-old who wants ice cream when they want the ice cream, right? You have to wait till the next day to have a discussion with them, or the day before, so you can have a rational discussion with that person. And so if you're somebody who finds yourself losing your emotions, again, if you're an elite athlete and you find anxiety is coming into your performance, or you're in business or you're in life and anxiety is becoming part of your environment, then you have to work on it when you are not in the anxious state, when you're not in the anxious environment. And you have to practice your skills, whether it's meditation, mindfulness, visualization, breath work, understanding yourself, providing yourself purpose and good narrative. Any of those things that you want to do, you've got to do it when you're not emotional, when you're not anxious, when you're not struggling, so that when you hit that environment, there's at least a 50-50 chance that you're going to get it right. Now, the longer you work on it, the more automatic it becomes, right? If you work on it long enough and you train the program long enough to know when I get into a, 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 an emer- a an anxious situation, this is how my body reacts, then that's how you will be programmed. Mm-hmm. But that takes time, and you have to build that skill while the big dog sleeps. And, you know, that's a skill we can all build, whether or not it's just I get angry because, you know, my coffee came out a little hotter or colder than I wanted, or I'm standing over a 3-foot putt in golf that's worth $2 million. It's right. It's exactly the same scenario inside the brain. The mind has no clue that two different scenarios.
Right. And I think that really explains well why you said earlier that part of your identity is a person who is present, right? Like you are in the moment. You've trained your brain to see it for what it is and to be more acting from the human brain rather than the monkey brain.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, it's funny. I've had a lot of conversations, and I often look at the date because, you know, I had probably by any standards a very large gambling problem, right? Mm-hmm. It was, you know, that and it went over a long period of time, and it cost a lot of money, and it did a lot of damage. It's you know, it was a very significant issue, but for at least 5 years, I have done zero work on stopping gambling.
Mm.
None. I don't go to gambling help. I don't go to psychologists to talk about gambling. I don't go and see, you know, people and discuss it and try and stay away from it. And the reason is, I tell people that, you know, so that's 5 years. I haven't done anything specifically for it. I haven't spent 8 years trying to stop gambling. I've actually spent 8 years trying to build the identity of a person I can be proud of. I'm not trying to fix something that was broken in the past. I'm trying to build something better in the future. And I've found that to be very significant in the fact that I don't focus on gambling. And therefore, my mind doesn't always go to gambling as its default. I don't smoke, so I don't focus on smoking. I don't live my life going, I better not smoke because I don't smoke. And so I don't live my life now saying I better not gamble because that's not who I am. I don't, you know, all of the things I don't do in my life, and everybody else out there is exactly the same. There are things that you don't do in your life that you'd never give a second thought to.
Yeah.
Right? However, when we seem to have a problem, the traditional way of trying to deal with that is to focus on the thing that you're trying to stop.
Right.
And what we do know of our mind is what we focus on. Well, as Tony Robbins says, where your focus goes, your energy grows, or something of that nature. And so if you keep focusing on the thing, it takes your energy away from building a new version of you. And, you know, I think it's been very important to me that that I've focused on building the new, not breaking down the old. And, you know, just purely because the new is so compelling to me, the old doesn't matter anymore.
Right. That reminds me of people making New Year's resolutions. They're like, I'm not going to do this anymore. It's like, what are you going to do instead? Because if you don't have something to fill your time with, you're going to fall back to that. And it's the same, the opposite direction, right? If you want to start doing something, but you don't look at your life and be like, what am I taking time away from so that I can do this new thing? You're kind of setting yourself up for failure. Like, it's not going to stick.
That's right. And I mean, in pretty much all of my practice, no matter whether it's for a professional performance or for a personal life, I would always work with somebody on creating the clear, conscious, and compelling identity and vision of the future first. Because we've all had the experience where we've cut something out of our life, right? We've gone on the diet, or we've, you know, given something up, or we've stopped drinking, or whatever the case may be. But eventually, if you're not moving towards something, you're just going to fall back to the thing in the past. So I really focus on building that first, because then when we get into the issues of what do you need to stop or change, or, you know, and again, it's not always to do with addictions. It may well be a high performance issue. So an athlete that is struggling with a particular aspect of their game, but if they don't know what they want it to look like, changing the thing doesn't really make much difference. because they could just change it into the next wrong thing and the next wrong thing. And so you have to be clear and conscious about what that looks like for you, because the more compelling you think about it like a bright light, if you can create a bright enough light, other things just become dim. Right? Your brain will never forget the trauma. It doesn't get over trauma. It doesn't eliminate it. And it's one of the misnomers that people have about dealing with trauma, or when they have a tough situation, it's like, I can just get over it, or I need to work through it. Or, you know, one of the things I like to say to people when I introduce myself in talks is, and this is a play on the Alcoholics Anonymous and the Gamblers Anonymous stuff, is, hello, my name's Gary. I'm an 8-year-old who believes in Santa Claus. Because if you go to Alcoholics Anonymous or you go to Gamblers Anonymous, they will ask you to stand up, introduce yourself, and tell them, everyone in the world, that you've got a problem. The difficulty I have with that is, I'm not an 8-year-old who believes in Santa Claus, just the same as I'm not a 35-year-old gambling addict. So I don't see the point in introducing myself as one when I'm not. However, I can still remember the fun of being an 8-year-old who believed in Santa Claus. And I can still remember the lessons I learned from being a gambling addict. They will always stay with you. But if you create something brighter to move towards in the future, the thing behind you doesn't go black. It doesn't disappear. It just becomes dimmer because the light's on, right? You know, that's a very important part, not only of performance, but of working through any trauma, difficulty, or mental health issue, is to create that compelling vision of the future, create that version that is so compelling for you. And you might not even know how you're going to do it, but you, people try and create the how before they create the who and the what. It's the other way around. You have to create and decide what the who and the what looks like, and then the how will come.
Have you found that people who figure out what they want to be have that vision for their future? Does their motivation day to day tend to be more steady than someone who went the other way around?
Yeah, I mean, if look, the first place I would always land with somebody is the who are you question. We always deal with the what do you want, but the who are you part is most important, because it's who you are that is going to chase down the what. Now, it's all well and good to say, I want $1 million and I want this job and I want to be the best at this, but for what purpose is the question I would always ask somebody. And unless you can answer for what purpose you want $1 million with very great specificity, like the answer can't just be because I just want $1 million, because it'd be great to have $1 million. If you can't answer the what is worth to you, for what purpose, then you have to go back and start again, because it's not really a sustainable model. And if you do find a lot of people that set themselves performance-based goals, they hit them, and then when they hit them, they're faced with two questions usually. Right. Is this it? Right, because we always hit our goals and we're like, I thought it'd be better. Or what next? Is this all there is? What's the point? Right. But if you create a who you are goal, again, that keeps going. And you might hit these performance goals along the way, but the who you are part keeps growing, it keeps developing, and it keeps moving you forward. And so, yes, I certainly find people that work on the who you are part and the what you want with specificity in relation to the who, they can sustain their motivation, if that's the right word for it, a lot longer than somebody who just wants to lose 10 kilos and that's it, or wants to win a gold medal and that's it. Because you can do what you need to for a year, and you can do what you need to maybe for 4 years, but you can't do it for the rest of your life unless you attach it to some greater meaning or purpose.
Right. And I think we're getting to the end of the episode, so I have one final question for you. And this is kind of the question that you pose to your clients. Who are you? What do you want? And how can people find you?
All right. Look, who I am, we probably touched on it before. I mean, I could probably wax lyrical about it, but I am a man of purpose. I am a man who is ensuring that his pain of the past means something. I'm now very blessed to have a baby daughter, and I've added to my purpose, and that is to be her standard. And, you know, I get very clear about what her standard is. Her standard is at some stage in the future she will meet a man and let a man into her life, whether that's as a relationship, whether it's as friends, whether it's as an employer. And my role is to ensure that she knows what the minimum standard of that man should be. And that's a man who lives with a level of integrity, who does what he says he's going to do, is fit and healthy and active. And, you know, that purpose drives me. And you know, following on from that again, it's a man who is grateful for the shit in his life and for the good stuff in his life, who is driven by being uncomfortable because that's where growth comes from. Disciplined to do the things that he says he's going to do to himself when he's by himself, to be present and to take that version of himself everywhere. So in this conversation, that guy comes fully. When I'm with my family, the same guy goes, but he goes there fully. When I go and play golf, that guy goes there, he goes there fully. And lastly, a man of service to take those lessons, to take what I'm moving towards and use it to help myself, to help my family, to help my friends, and to help anybody that needs it and wants to come along for the ride. It's not just about helping them in a coaching and a business way, but you know, if there's some way that what I've lived, learned, and earned can help somebody, well, you know, that's what making my pain worth it would be. So who am I? That's who I'd like to be, and that's who I keep working towards. Like I said, I'm not that every day. I'm not that probably any day, but I'm certainly getting a lot closer every day. Every day I wake up.
That's beautiful. And if people are interested in learning more about you or finding you, where can they do that?
Yeah, the best place is probably garyfay.com. It's just my name. All my business, Strong Mend, MEND. Mm-hmm. If they Google either, you'll probably find it. I'm on Instagram and Facebook and YouTube and LinkedIn, I think, in different personas. My Strong Men tends to be more about counseling and coaching for men, and my Neurostoic Solutions or my Gary Fay page is more in that performance, high-performance field, a little bit of crisis management for high-performance people.
Amazing.
Come and check me out. And if you're interested, I love having free coffee with anyone. If anyone ever wants a chat, I never say no. So you're more than welcome to reach out, have a free coffee, and see if something I've learned can help you out.
Right, and I'm sure the people who are listening will have learned something. I certainly feel like I have. Thank you so much for being on, Gary.
I appreciate you, Erica. Thank you for having me on. It's been a great conversation, and hopefully we'll do it again another time.
Thanks for listening to today's episode. If you enjoyed, please send this to a friend who could use the advice, whether they have gone through a hard time or are going through one right now and could use a little bit of light and direction in finding out what their next chapter in life will be. If you have thoughts or tips you'd like to share, please do at Self Help Junkie Pod on Instagram, Twitter, or Gmail. I'll see you guys next time.